Delaney.
I'm Deborah Wong. Robin Young is off today.
It's Here and Now.
The Iraq prison abuse scandal continues to send shockwaves through Washington and beyond. Members of Congress are demanding that the Pentagon explain how the abuse at the Abu Ghraib prison outside Baghdad occurred. Army officials were called to testify today before a closed session of the Senate Armed Services Committee. Arizona Senator John McCain said until now, lawmakers have been kept in the dark about the details of the Army's investigations.
The Congress should have been notified of this situation a long time ago. It's a neglect of the responsibilities that Secretary Rumsfeld and the civilian leaders of the Pentagon have to keep the Congress informed of an issue of this magnitude.
McCain said Secretary Rumsfeld would be called to testify before Congress on the treatment of prisoners in Iraq. Earlier, we spoke with Pam Hess, Pentagon correspondent for United Press International, on the military's reaction to the unfolding scandal.
Privately, people at the Pentagon and certainly people over in Iraq are calling this a disaster. And it also makes things incredibly dangerous for them on the ground. The 1st Armored Division is going around in the area that they are south of Baghdad. And every Iraqi that they come in contact with, the lowest foot soldier is instructed to explain to them and to apologize personally for what happened, to explain that they're not taught to do this and that this is the kind of behavior that they came into Iraq to stop. So it becomes part of the history now. And it's something that they're going to have to live down.
Let's talk about the reaction from the Pentagon. We're still waiting, are we not, for Donald Rumsfeld to say something publicly on this scandal?
He's mentioned it a bit and sort of, you know, expressed his concern about it. But he does have one actual legal problem, which is he is in the chain of command. And because there are 6 soldiers that are facing crimes under the Military Code of Justice, Don Rumsfeld can't really say anything without giving a possibility for appeal for them as having he maybe having prejudiced the outcome by expressing his feelings about it.
President Bush apparently telephoned Secretary Rumsfeld yesterday with concerns about this incident. What was said, do you know?
President Bush apparently told Rumsfeld that he wanted to make sure that these people were punished to the fullest extent of the law, which I think runs back into that question of are you prejudicing the outcome of the 6 different trials that are going to have to go on for these 6 people that are charged.
Is there a fear within the Pentagon that this scandal may widen even further and that there are other incidents out there that are yet to come to light?
That is one thing that they're facing. The Taguba report, which you've heard about, which is what Cy Hirsch wrote about in The New Yorker, is classified. I haven't seen it, but apparently talks about wider spread abuse. There was the case at Bagram Air Base in December 2002 when a prisoner in Afghanistan died apparently of injuries suffered at the hands of U.S. troops. The report on that has not yet come out. The Army finished it about 2 weeks ago, but it got sent back down for more details. So I think there is a question of how widespread this is. I also think that there's a larger issue, and hopefully I'll be able to talk to Rumsfeld about this today at the Pentagon briefing, and that is by declaring a class of prisoners enemy combatants at Guantanamo Bay or security detainees in Iraq and in Afghanistan that are not prisoners of war and therefore do not have the explicit protections of the Geneva Conventions, are you creating a situation where soldiers think that they can get away with this with something less than humane treatment? So I think it's a policy question as well as a criminal question.
Pam, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Pam Hess is Pentagon correspondent for United Press International.
One of the surprises for many to emerge from the scandal of alleged sexual and physical abuse of Iraqi prisoners is that at least 2 of the accused are civilians, contractors hired to interrogate Iraqi detainees. They reportedly worked for the Titan and Kaki corporations. Joining us is retired Colonel Bob Killebrew. He joins us from Newport News, Virginia. Welcome, Colonel Killebrew.
Hello, how are you?
Colonel, thanks for joining us. Yeah, you know, Colonel, we did a simple Google search. We found online, within minutes, ads at a website, Defense Systems and Intelligence Careers, for positions in Iraq, debriefer, interrogator, senior counterintelligence agents, lots of jobs. They go on for pages and pages. How much more widespread in the Iraq war is the use of civilian contractors as compared to previous wars?
Well, it's pretty widespread. I'd say right now probably the armed forces of the United States couldn't fight wars without contractors.
Now, why is that? There are just less soldiers after the drawdowns of the 90s?
Previously, contractors tended to be highly skilled technical individuals who perhaps might know how to work or repair one esoteric weapon system that was one of a kind that it just wasn't profitable for soldiers or sailors to be trained to fix. But since the drawdowns, the services have had to contract out many, many functions so that now contractors pervade the services.
What do they do?
They do everything. They do everything from running mess halls and feeding soldiers to, as we've seen in the news, interrogating prisoners. They're training officers and NCOs and enlisted people at the training centers. They're writing important defense documents. They're doing almost everything that commissioned officers and non-commissioned officers, and in some cases enlisted soldiers, used to do 20 years ago.
Do they fight? Do they pull triggers?
They do not. The Rumsfeld DOD has said that they like the use of contractors, and they would like to scale the services down to the point where soldiers and sailors are only doing those essential military skills, which I think we do define as pulling triggers. Everything else, though, is open to contractors.
So let me ask you a simple question. When an officer walks into the room, does the civilian salute just like the soldier? How does that work?
No, he doesn't. And that's the blurry line we're getting into right now, and in particular in the case of this prison problem. A contractor is a paid employee, and even if he or she is a retired military officer or a non-commissioned officer, they are civilians, and their legal status is of civilians.
What do you see as the problem with that, if there is a problem with that?
Well, the downside is it can tend to confuse lines of responsibility and authority, as you see in this case. I have no knowledge, I'd like to say, of the specifics of this investigation. But clearly you had people working in interrogator positions in that prison who were contractors. And it can get blurry, particularly if you have retired military officers or non-commissioned officers are working alongside people who are junior to their retired rank.
Like yourself, Colonel, right?
Like myself. I do consulting for the Department of Defense, and I frequently work with people who would have been junior to me in the service and who are kind of obliged by their professional courtesy to treat me with the respect of my retired rank.
Colonel, just to finish up, you said Donald Rumsfeld's Defense Department likes civilian contractors. Could this lead someday to essentially would be a mercenary army?
That's a hard question. The adjustment of that line between the active duty military people and the retired military people or the civilian contractors who are working for them is going to take a lot of thought. We've never put an army into the field like this that was so dependent on contractors so far forward in the battle area.
Retired Colonel Bob Killebrew joined us from Newport News, Virginia. Colonel, thanks as always.
No problem at all.
The behavior of American soldiers holding prisoners of war is governed by the Geneva Convention. But what governs the behavior of civilian contractors in a war zone? To talk about the legal questions that the prison scandal raises, we're joined by Charles Tiefer, University of Baltimore law professor and former deputy counsel of the U.S. House of Representatives. Professor Tiefer, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Now, six soldiers in this case, we're told, are facing criminal charges. But what about these civilian contractors who were also found to have had some responsibility for the abuse? Could they face penalties as well?
Well, to some extent, we're in legal limbo, uncharted territory, because in the Iraq conflict occupation, the use of contractors has expanded to a degree never seen before. And so we don't have a precedent for knowing what kind of penalties would be imposed upon them.
When they go into a war zone, they do sign contracts, and the companies that employ them sign contracts with the U.S. military. What kinds of wording is there in these contracts that might govern their behavior?
Well, they promise to undertake certain tasks competently. There's usually not elaborately written standards for how they are to perform the contract. They're to perform it under the supervision of the U.S. government.
Now, how about the employees who work for these companies? Is there anything in their contracts that specify you shall not abuse prisoners, you shall not do any of these things?
They would be given some guidance about what their tasks would be under the supervision of those they're working with. And I note that the report that was issued that has gotten a lot of attention included a recommendation of termination for one of these employees. That's fairly standard in government contracting.
Although it seems like a fairly light punishment given the kinds of abuse that these contractors have been accused of.
Their livelihood is working for the government. This isn't just sort of a casual one-time gig. These contractors depend upon repeat contracts. Their employees depend upon repeat employment. I'm not disagreeing that it's lighter than, say, criminal punishment, but it's a severe economic punishment if pushed to the limit.
Let's talk about liability then. These are private companies, as you said, offering services to the military. Are the companies liable, say, in a civil court for the actions of their employees?
The basic answer is yes, in that from the Vietnam War, the contractors who made Agent Orange, if they made it negligently or labeled it negligently, and their lawsuit went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said they had no absolute defense. They could be sued for hurting people because of the effects of Agent Orange due to their own negligence. And so the contractors can be held liable.
And as a result of those cases, didn't many companies insist on indemnity clauses in their contracts so that they would not be held liable for any kinds of actions in a war zone?
That's correct. There was a famous example where Bechtel, in order to take on one of the major contracts in Iraq reconstruction, insisted on an indemnification clause, which in that instance could only come from the personal approval of President Bush, which was given.
Mm-hmm.
I do not know at all that Cassie or the other contractors involved in handling prisoners would have had a similar reason to push the Secretary of Defense to say, we need immunity.
And do you think that we're going to see lawsuits in the future about this incident?
I don't know about outside lawsuits, but it would not surprise me if we have the kind of Inspector General investigations and potential suspension proceedings or proceedings to charge payment for negligent activity, the contractors, those kinds of government-imposed sanctions on the contractors we might very well see.
Professor, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Professor Charles Tiefer teaches law at the University of Baltimore Law School, and he's the author of the book Contract Law.
Just ahead, what makes millions of computers vulnerable as never before to the latest worldwide worm?
And later in the show, the filmmaker who ate only at McDonald's for a month and got supersized.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Deborah Wong.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Estimates are that hundreds of thousands of computers worldwide have been affected by a new computer worm. Sasser and its variations can cause computers to continually crash and reboot. To find out more about the Sasser worm, we're joined by Dee Liebenstein with the information security firm Symantec. Dee, welcome.
Thank you.
Dee, this is quite a computer worm. A TV network in Europe was hit. The Taiwan Post Office lost a third of its computers. What is the Sasser worm?
Well, the Sasser worm is a little bit different than what most people think of as a computer worm. Typically, when you think of a computer worm, you think of something that comes to you in your email inbox
right. That
you click on and then something bad happens. With Sasser, it's actually spreading automatically by scanning the internet, looking for computer systems that are vulnerable. Basically, they have a vulnerability in their operating system that has not been patched. If it finds one of those systems, it infects it, and then that system starts spreading the virus as well.
A vulnerability not patched. What does that mean?
What that means, basically, is a vulnerability is a flaw in a software program, and it's an error that needs to be fixed by an update to the software, the security patch. If you download and apply that security patch for this specific vulnerability, this worm can't hit you.
How do you know if you have the vulnerability so that you can patch it?
Well, the best thing to do is go to your vendor's website, in this case it's Microsoft, and download the most recent security patches for your operating system.
Because this is hitting exclusively, as I understand it, Microsoft Windows, Windows 2000, Windows Server 2003, and Windows XP, right?
Correct.
Dee, just to finish up, do you think that the average computer user is too complacent about maintaining their computer with these patches and so on to prevent this sort of thing, particularly given that this one just seems to launch onto the Internet, and if you're on the Internet, you're vulnerable?
Well, I think that everyone needs to think about a mind change on how they think about their computer. I think we all used to think about a computer as an entertainment system, if you will. You know, you buy a TV, you plug it in, and it works. And that's the way we always traditionally thought about computers in the home. And I think we need to think about it as a machine you need to maintain. If you have a car, you need to get your oil changed. If you have a computer connected to the Internet, you need to maintain it by making sure that you have all the most recent updates to the operating system and applications you run on your computer, and you have an up-to-date security solution for antivirus and firewall.
Dee Liebenstein is a group manager for the information security company Symantec. Dee, thanks a lot for cluing us in on this.
Thank you.
One out of every 59 women in the United States, that's about 25,000 women a year, will get ovarian cancer. If the cancer is caught early, the survival rate is good, but the vast majority of cases are detected only after the disease is far advanced. Scientists are now working on new tests that may allow for the early detection of ovarian cancer. Here in Now's regular health columnist Judy Foreman is here to tell us about the new technologies that may improve the odds. Hi, Judy.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Well, first of all, can you explain why ovarian cancer is so hard to detect in its early stages?
Well, obviously, there are no easy tests for it, and the symptoms are very vague. Women get kind of swollen bellies as if they were 4 or 5 months pregnant. They feel gas and abdominal discomfort, but doctors usually think that's some sort of stomach trouble or intestinal trouble, so women usually get worked up for that, and only after that or in the process of that do doctors realize it's ovarian cancer. It's really tough to diagnose.
And so for those who are diagnosed with late-stage ovarian cancer, how deadly is the disease at that point?
As you said, in the early stages, you have a very good chance, a 95% chance of living 5 years or more. Once it's past stage 2, 3, 4, once it's in those stages, it can range from 31% to 70% 5-year survival, which is not great.
Right now, do doctors have a way of detecting it?
They have kind of a hodgepodge method for detecting it in women that they already know are at high risk, like women whose mothers have had ovarian cancer. And for them, they do a combination of things. They do a test called CA125, which looks for a particular marker that often occurs with ovarian cancer. They do a pelvic ultrasound and a pelvic exam. Those things together, if they all point in the direction of ovarian cancer, suggest, you know, maybe exploratory surgery. But that CA125 test is not good enough to use with normal, healthy, non-high-risk women. There's sort of a problem with the CA125 also, which is every once in a while emails go around the net with women saying, we demand having this test. But this is not a test that women should demand because it's just not good enough. And a not reliable test is really worse than no test at all.
So scientists are now working on more reliable tests?
Yes, they're using a new tool called proteomics, which is the study of all proteins made in cells. It's like genomics looks at genes and proteomics looks at proteins. Traditionally, when doctors are trying to detect something like a cancer, they look for one marker, one protein that is specific to that particular cancer, and they look for it in the blood or the urine, and that's a telltale sign that cancer may be present. With this proteomics approach for ovarian cancer, they're looking at a whole slew of proteins, hundreds, and it's not what those individual proteins do that matters. It's the fingerprints. Some of the proteins may be increased, some may be decreased, and it's the whole fingerprint of how that signature looks together that is the tip-off that there may be ovarian cancer present.
Is this useful for other cancers as well?
Yes, the same idea would be very useful for other cancers.
So this new technology, is it that good? Is it close to being out on the market?
Well, one company would have you say, CoreLogic, says that they're still hoping to get their test on the market by the end of the year. Most other scientists say that that test isn't good enough yet because it hasn't been validated. You don't really have much room for error, and any error would send a lot of women through this surgery unnecessarily. But there are a lot of other companies and also the federal government working very hard on this as well.
There are competing technologies out there?
There are competing technologies, and the competition is fierce.
Judy, thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
Judy Foreman is Here and Now's regular health columnist. For more, visit our website, here-now.org.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, perhaps the most thorough biography yet of Senator John Kerry.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Deborah Wong.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The head of a U.S.-funded Iraqi newspaper, Al-Sabah, has quit in protest and taken his staff with him. Editor-in-chief Ismail Zayer said, quote, "We had a project to create a free media in Iraq, but they," meaning the Pentagon and the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq, "are trying to control us. We are being suffocated," said the editor. So Zayer plans to start his own newspaper, which begins publishing today. It's called, in English, The New Morning. Joining us on the line is journalist Amar Al-Shabander. He's Iraq country director at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting based in London. Hello, Mr. Al-Shabander.
Hello.
Tell me about the editor who resigned, Ismail Zayer. You know him. What kind of man and journalist is he?
Well, Ismail Zayer worked for many Arabic-speaking newspapers based in Europe for many years, actually. He was and remains a very active journalist and basically a supporter of free speech. What Ismail did, he came to Iraq back in last April, that's 2003, after the liberation of Iraq, and he started Al-Sabah newspaper. His idea from the beginning was to establish basically a free, independent, and progressive newspaper. What happened is the CPA at that time, that's the Coalition's Provisional Authority, was looking to a credible newspaper or a credible editor/journalist to basically be the main news outlet for the CPA. And so was Mr. Ismail Zayer contracted for that issue.
And so what has apparently happened is that he feels he's being censored by the Coalition Provisional Authority?
Well, there are two concerns. The first concern is this one, actually, that he is losing his editorial independence. The other issue is Ismail Zayer's plan from the beginning was to establish an independent newspaper to be funded by AID or CPA, and then it basically becomes his own.
I see.
So there are two issues here. First, his own personal interest, and then the issue of editorial independence, which is almost an ideological issue.
You know, you followed the progress of the Pentagon-funded Al-Sabah newspaper on your website, the Iraqi Press Monitor. I found a recent editorial written by Mr. Zayer, the man who's just resigned. Here's a line from it referring to a postponed Arab summit. He says, "Whether the Arab summit was postponed or not, the Arab people will remain as they are because Arab leaders are far removed from the sufferings of their citizens." Now, interestingly, that sounds like what U.S. officials would like to hear in Iraqi newspapers, right?
This time, he happened to basically believe the same thing as the American officials. Mm-hmm. But many other times, he might say something that does not appeal to CPA or American officials. So whether he agrees with American officials or not, he wants to have an independent editorial line.
Mr. Al-Shabandar, just to finish up, you follow the Iraqi press all the time.
Yeah.
You follow the Iraqi media all the time. How free is the press and the media in Iraq at this point?
Well, it's a tricky question because thinking about how free Iraqi media is from a professional point of view, definitely the newspapers are free in what they are publishing. I mean, there is no oversight or censorship, but at the same time, they are promoting the agendas of their funders.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there is no professional media in the Western sense of media professionality in Iraq. However, the media outlets, Iraqi media outlets, which are mainly newspapers, are free in what they are writing.
And certainly more free than under Saddam Hussein.
Oh, definitely, definitely. There is no comparison. I mean, we cannot compare with Saddam's era at all. This wouldn't be fair.
Amer Al-Shabandar is Iraq Country Director at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting in London. Mr. Al-Shabandar, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
It appears the little guy is now playing a bigger role in American politics. During the month of March, President Bush raised 39% of his campaign financing from donors writing checks for under $200. That same month, Senator John Kerry raised even more money from small donors than the president. We thought we'd ask Steve Weissman to explain the trend. He's Associate Director for Policy at the Campaign Finance Institute. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me in.
Overall, you found that both President Bush and Senator Kerry in March were raising about 30% of their campaign funds from small donors, and that's a big jump for both of them. So what's going on here?
Well, clearly this is a major potential source of funding for candidates. And as John Kerry had needed money quickly, he turned to small donors as well as others, including through the Internet. And President Bush has obviously stepped up his efforts. Both have now raised about twice as much as they had done before in proportional terms from small donors. They had both been under 20% of their money was coming from small donors, and now they're well over 35%.
So is it a question of the candidates targeting small donors, or is it a question of small donors stepping up to the plate and saying, take my money?
Obviously, there's some kind of demand from small donors. I mean, there's a potential for, yeah, we want to give, but they have to be asked. And I think the candidates, have kind of seen the small donors as a real resource. The small donors have always vastly outnumbered large donors. In fact, there's about 1 million small donors so far, or over 1 million perhaps, in the presidential race at this point. In the past, there's been maybe about 100,000 or so. Now there's more, maybe a couple of 100,000 larger donors. So there's a great potential. There's a lot of people out there who want to participate, but it's been easier for candidates generally to seek out the great proportion of their money from large donors.
So is this the Howard Dean effect? Is this the candidates seeing what was possible if you appeal more to the grassroots?
I think that's quite a bit of it. Howard Dean had raised, about half of all the Democratic money in small donations came to Howard Dean. And so clearly he's shown a lot of the potential. On the other hand, though, I don't think we should forget that there's still more money coming from $1,000 and now, since changes in the campaign finance law, $2,000 donors. Basically, about two-thirds of that money is in large donations and only about a third in small donations.
What do you think, looking at these numbers, the donors' motivations are? Is this a sign to you of the sort of divisiveness of this campaign, that people feel very strongly either for one candidate or for another?
That could be playing into it, but it isn't just the divisiveness of the campaign. It's the fact that it's going on quite a long time. Both major candidates have refused public financing, which had some spending limits. It also had some encouragements to go after small donors, by the way. And because they've refused public financing and have unlimited spending, they can collect as much as they want from large and small donors. So naturally, they're getting more money from both large and small donors, particularly the winning candidates, neither of whom were in the public financing system.
Steve, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Steve Weissman is Associate Director for Policy at the Campaign Finance Institute.
Still to come, a filmmaker goes on an unusual diet and makes a movie about it called Supersize Me.
You're listening to Here and Now.
The western United States is bracing for fire season during its sixth year of drought. Conditions are prime for wildfires and water wars, as reservoirs, lakes, and rivers are at half capacity in Utah, New Mexico, and Nevada. In Colorado, residents are facing restrictions on water use. And in Arizona, soil is the driest it's been in a century. But one of the driest areas west of the Mississippi is the Jefferson River Basin in Montana. It has been classified on the latest federal index as an area of, quote, exceptional drought, unquote. One Montana official likened conditions in Beaverhead County to those of the Dust Bowl. Joining us on the line from Bozeman, Montana, is Christian Science Monitor correspondent Todd Wilkinson. Todd, welcome.
Great to be here.
Todd, thanks for joining us. You live in Montana. Tell me what it looks like there.
Last week, I had the chance to drive through the Jefferson River Basin, and indeed, it resembled what I had heard it looked like during the Dust Bowl.
And this is the heart of what's called Montana's beef basket?
Yes, it is. And to put you in the right frame of mind for the Jefferson River Basin, what you need to do is cue up the soundtrack for Bonanza. There are lots and lots of Cartwright families living on large cattle ranches in western Montana. And I suppose this year, in addition to having the Bonanza soundtrack, you'd be toting along a copy of Grapes of Wrath.
Is there any explanation for the drought?
You know, I think it's a combination. 3 years ago, meteorologists thought that the drought would break, and indeed, we started to have good rains in the spring, but those were negated by abnormally high temperatures and high winds, which dries everything out quickly here.
Todd, what does this do to the economy in Montana?
Well, in a place like western Montana, which is a huge beef producer and which also relies upon alfalfa crops and wheat crops and barley, you have a trauma that has set in. I was told by one of the ranchers that every dollar that gets produced recycles itself seven times throughout these communities.
Have meteorologists made any predictions about how long this drought will continue?
When I spoke with someone from the National Weather Service, she chuckled and said there's a 50% chance of getting precipitation above average and 50% chance of getting rains below average.
Beaverhead and 11 other counties are receiving federal disaster status, I understand?
Yes, they recently applied for it, and I spoke with one of our senators who told me that, indeed, he is seeking disaster status.
Todd, what does it mean to get disaster relief assistance?
Part of the package could mean relief from having to pay water assessments that are assessed to ranchers who would normally receive water coming out of irrigation projects, even if they don't receive any of the water. Some of it could be perhaps debt relief relating to bills that are outstanding, related to machinery and other things like that.
What's this doing to the kind of the psychology of people in that beautiful part of the country?
Again, along the Jefferson River Basin, you have ranching families that go back literally to the frontier. And they've, dating back to the 70s, have been beset by tough times. And so some of them worry that this drought could be the knockout blow. And if they go, it's very possible that you would have a residential subdivision replacing them in these wonderful rural valleys.
We've been joined from Bozeman, Montana, by Christian Science Monitor correspondent Todd Wilkinson. Todd, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Wong.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
On Thanksgiving 2002, filmmaker Morgan Spurlock had what he's calling a really great bad idea. In the tradition of his short-lived MTV reality show, I Bet You Will, Spurlock dared himself to eat all of his meals at McDonald's for 30 days straight. The fast food binge and its dramatic effects on Spurlock's health. His cholesterol skyrocketed and he gained over 20 pounds are documented in the new film, Super Size Me, which opens this Friday.
Hello, can I help you?
Yeah, could I get the double quarter pounder with cheese meal?
Mine says supersize.
I think I'm going to have to go supersize. Look at that. Look at that Coke. That barely fits in there. Look at that. Look at how big that thing is. Look how big that French fry is. That thing is like 4 feet tall. Double quarter pounder with cheese. More calories than anything. There it is. A little bit of heaven. Mmm.
During his month-long fling with big burgers, big fries, and big soft drinks, Spurlock also interviewed health experts, lawyers, and legislators about this country's obsession with food and with fat. After all was said and done, Supersize Me went on to win the Documentary Director's Award at Sundance. Here and Now producer Andrea Shea recently met with Morgan Spurlock at McDonald's to talk about what drove him to make this fast-paced film about fast food.
I was sitting on my couch in Beckley, West Virginia. You know, I'm feeling all tryptophaned out like we all do on Thanksgiving Day when on the news, you know, there was somebody, a spokesman for McDonald's came on the air talking about the lawsuits. You know, these two girls, you know, were suing McDonald's. And the spokesperson came on the air and said, you can't link our food to these girls being sick. You can't link our food to these girls being obese. Our food is healthy. It's nutritious. It's good for you. And so the light went off in my head and I said, well, if it's that good for me, then I should be able to eat it for breakfast, lunch, and dinner for 30 days straight with no side effects, right? And that was the impetus for the whole thing.
So how does it feel to be back at Mickey D's?
It feels pretty good, you know, like being back in your old stale bed. they all kind of have that same smell. You ever notice that? Kind of like deep-fried cleaning solvent. The thing is, I come in here and I just smell the food. And for me, it's like even to this day, if I smell a Big Mac, my mouth will start watering immediately and will want it. Like, I will crave it. But I can't eat it because I know the minute I eat it, I will be completely disgusted by it. You know, like if I take a bite of a Big Mac, I'll chew it and swallow it and I'll get this like film in my mouth, you know, that just kind of comes from their food, which I don't even know what that is. It's like I've become so hypersensitive to the food that I can't stomach it.
Yet, your mouth waters.
Yeah, pretty creepy. And that's what keeps them coming back.
You know, you said you wanted to tell a story of why Americans are overweight and fat happy, and you started off doing something that's kind of amusing. It sounds amusing, at least at first, that you're going to eat only McDonald's for a month. You know, it adds great drama to your film. But did you exaggerate the effects of the fast food on your system at all?
I mean, how can I exaggerate a blood test? How can I exaggerate a lab test? What you see in the film, how I feel, what happens to me, is what happened. You know, there's no way to make this up. I can't automatically make my liver fill with fat and put enzymes out into my body. You know, over the course of the movie, I got ill. I was incredibly depressed. I had massive headaches that could only be alleviated by eating this food. So over the course of the month, you see my body completely degrade to the point of where I was, you know, so sick that my doctor was like, you need to stop because we don't know what's going to happen to you.
And also, I mean, your girlfriend is a vegan. You eat generally healthy. You know, you're not a vegan, but you eat well. So, I mean, you started off at a certain place, and it probably shocked your system to a certain extent, whereas other people, if they kind of grew up on McDonald's...
Well, you got to look at what happened at the end of the film. You bring up a very good point, because look what happened at the very end of the movie. After my body peaked out, and the doctors told me to quit, but I kept eating. So after the 30 days, my cholesterol came down a little bit. My liver function came down a little bit. Was everything going to come back to the baseline where I started at the beginning of the movie? No, the doctors even said that wasn't going to happen. So what was going on? My body was starting to adapt to the environment that I put it in. And so now you got to think, how many people who lead this typical American lifestyle of overeating and under-exercising, their bodies aren't just living every day, but where our bodies are now adapting and surviving. You know, that's a scary thing to think about.
And there's a lot more going on in this film than just your daily life at McDonald's, your three squares a day at McDonald's.
Yeah.
And, of course, these 30 days did provide, I think, a great framework for your film and the story you wanted to tell.
My story is much as like the skeleton on which the entire movie was just built upon. The movie has a lot more than that. This is the one thing people just kind of latch onto, thinking that this is all that it's about. And it's a much larger examination of our culture, of fast food society, you know, this fast food world that we live in, and how it's influenced every part of our life, you know, from the way we eat to our kids eat, and, I mean, to the entire world. I mean, now American fast food culture has permeated every country around the globe.
People are saying and are going to continue saying that this is just some sort of another nasty reality show kind of an experiment, and maybe even it's an extension of your MTV show, Bet You Will, where you basically paid people money to eat jars of mayonnaise and stuff like that.
Everybody who's had these things to say about the film are from lobby groups, from groups that get paid by the food corporations to say these things, to spin things out of control, to discredit, you know, whatever comes their way, you know, so that they continue to be the shining light.
But film reviewers also said this sort of thing.
Yeah.
And what about your motivations?
You know, I've wanted to make a feature film for a long time. You know, it's been one of my long-term goals was to make a film. And when I had the idea for this, I thought it was something that we could accomplish fairly cheaply. I thought it was a very good idea at the right time. You know, you couldn't turn on the TV or open a newspaper, read a magazine without hearing about, you know, the obesity epidemic in America. And I thought it was something that needed to be addressed. You know, I grew up in a house where food was very important. And I'm in a relationship, you know, where food is very important. And I think we live in a culture where we've become so distanced from our food, and there's no relationship now between us and our food. And, you know, the empty calories, you know, also go into, like, an empty life. We're not feeding ourselves beyond just this machination of eating.
And you make the link that a lot of researchers have made between the rise in obesity and to the rise of fast food here in this country. You talk to nutritionalists, cardiologists, but do you feel like you made a balanced film? Because you obviously have an agenda just hearing you speak.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I made a very fair film. You know, I gave McDonald's, which is the largest corporation, the whole reason is people say, you know, you can't blame McDonald's for the obesity epidemic, you know, which I don't blame McDonald's for the obesity epidemic. I never say it's McDonald's fault. McDonald's is iconic of the problem to me. They are the company that every other corporation emulates. Every other company follows their business practices. So by picking them, in my mind, I was picking the company that I believed could most easily institute change. Because if they decided to change their ways, every other company would follow. And now look what's happened. You know, since the movie showed at Sundance for the first time, 6 weeks later, they announced they were doing away with supersize options. And they said it has nothing to do with this film whatsoever. Just last week, they announced they were rolling out, you know, their Go Active Adult Happy Meals. When did the Go Active Adult Happy Meals hit the stores? May 6th. When does the movie open? May 7th. Once again, it's another amazing coincidence that has nothing to do with the film whatsoever. So the film is having a tremendous impact. And I think I presented a film that showed the truth of what could happen to you if you, over the course of your entire life, do as most Americans do, which is overeat and under-exercise.
This movie isn't for the faint of heart. It's pretty gross at times. You vomit. You show a gastric bypass operation graphically on film. Do you think the film needed to be gross to be effective?
See, I don't think the film is gross. I think that's just, you know, certain people's feelings about it. I mean, in my mind, I think the film's very honest. I mean, we live in an extreme world right now where people are getting their stomachs cut down to the size of a small apple to control their weight. I think that the film really presents a picture that is as scary as it is, you know, questioning.
You called McDonald's a number of times during the film to get their comments. Did they ever give you a solid reason why they wouldn't talk to you?
No, they wouldn't talk to me. You know, so I would call them and they'd say, well, maybe we could set up an interview. You know, let's see what we can do next week. Well, we'll send this around and see what people have to say. And it was the runaround. But if I could ask them a question, if I could sit down with, you know, Charlie Bell, the new CEO, if I could ask him one thing, I'd say, Charlie, I got one question. Why doesn't the clown eat the food? Why does the clown take the kids inside and play with them and have a good old time and give it to them, but he never eats it? You know, he's tall and he's skinny, but he never eats the food.
In the film, you basically compare Ronald McDonald to a drug pusher. That's a pretty scary image.
Yeah, it works, though, doesn't it?
The world is round, and so am I.
Filmmaker Morgan Spurlock talking about his new documentary, Supersize.
Supersize, supersize the American way. Throw it down all day, every day. Supersize, supersize the American way. Getting fat, getting broke, either way you're gonna pay.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Deborah Wong.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Supersize me. Supersize me. Now I can't get out of bed, so I have to order in. I'm a triple fat fatty, and I have a triple chin.
Who's for a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. On the web at MathWorks.com.